You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
In 1945, a farmer in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, found a pottery jar that had over 50 papyrus documents, many of them bound together as books. Written in the Coptic language, they became known as the Nag Hammadi Library. The most famous of the books is the Gospel of Thomas. Now, while the Gospel of Thomas didn't make the cut into the canon of the New Testament with Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, it's come to be embraced by those that study this kind of thing as a document on par with those Gospels. Thomas is different from the other Gospels because it's what's called a sayings gospel. There's no narrative of the life of Jesus, no messianic claims, no crucifixion, no resurrection, no final judgment, just advice on how to live. So what makes some traditionalists nervous is that in Thomas, we have evidence that there was a community of Jesus followers for whom Jesus' death and resurrection were not that important. What was emphasized were Jesus' teachings about life. Some of you might remember my friend Stephen Patterson from when he preached here. He's written a number of books on the Gospel of Thomas and is among those scholars who are part of the early school who believe the evidence points to Thomas having been written very early. Some scholars say Thomas came after our biblical Gospels, maybe even in the second century, but Stephen and others think it's closer to Jesus than even Paul. I texted Stephen and he confirmed that this particular saying is very early, maybe even as early as 40. That's 10 years after Jesus' death. And maybe one of the few sayings that is completely original to Jesus. The parable we're going to hear is also in Mark, Matthew, and Luke. But Thomas' version is very short, and if you compare them, you can clearly see how the other Gospels kept adding more and more stuff. I like Thomas' version because it cuts right to the chase.
Our words of wisdom are selections from the Gospel of Thomas, Logion 9. The Patterson Translation.
Jesus said, "Look, a sower went out. He filled his hands with seeds, and he scattered them. Some fell on the path, and the birds came and pecked them up. Others fell on the rock and did not take root in the soil, and they did not put forth ears.
And others fell among the thorns. They choked the seeds, and worms ate them. And others fell on good soil, and it produced good fruit. It yielded 60 per measure and 120 per measure."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to her church.
Thanks be to God.
I trained to be a teacher, and I think all of us with that inclination sometimes get overzealous in wanting our students to learn. I remember hearing the story of one teacher who was doing a science lesson on how plants grow. The children all got a chance to plant their own seeds. Always thinking ahead, the teacher planted a few extra seeds for the children whose plants didn't sprout. After a few weeks of watching the seeds progress, she secretly exchanged a few cups. The next day, one of her students said, "Look, teacher, look! It's a miracle! My plant is growing!" And the teacher said, "Yes, seed sprouting is very exciting." He said, "No, teacher, that's not the miracle. I ate the seed you gave me. And it's growing anyway!" Well, one of the things that I like about this parable is that there's really no miracle to it, no grand leap of faith. It's just a simple observation about the way the world really is. It's not even original to Jesus. Nearly 400 years before Jesus, Plato wrote, "People are like dirt. They can either nourish you and help you grow as a person, or they can stunt your growth and make you wilt and die." So Jesus is essentially calling us dirt. But don't be offended. Think about the Genesis 2 creation story. God takes clay or dirt and breathes ruach, spirit, into it to create an earth creature, Ha-Adam. We are dust animated by spirit. If you do want to get literal, we are more specifically dust, stardust to be precise. The flesh of our bodies was forged in the heart of stars being born billions of years ago. Dirt, dust, soil, animated by the Spirit. We read this parable and naturally identify with one of the four kinds of soil. Probably the good soil, yes? But if we're honest, we know that at any given moment, any given hour, any given day, the type of soil we are is different, because each one of us embodies all four soils, depending on our prejudices, experiences, weaknesses. So how can we nourish the dirt that we are? How might we be more receptive to the Spirit germinating something new in us, taking root in us? If you're a gardener or familiar with regenerative agriculture, you may have heard the expression, "Feed the soil, and the soil feeds you." But for our purposes, think about changing just one letter in soil, so you get, "Feed the soul, and the soul feeds you." But let's be honest. We don't live in a world that is conducive to feeding anyone's soul. More often than not, the world is in soul-crushing mode. And it's not just the high demands of modern culture or the distraction of media and entertainment of every kind. We're being targeted. Your attention isn't drifting. It's being harvested. There are entire multi-billion-dollar algorithmically optimized behavior-shaping industries whose bottom line depends on making sure you never notice what's right in front of you. We are, without question, the most informed people who have ever lived. We are inundated with what's happening in Ukraine, Iran, Washington, Silicon Valley, and whatever fresh chaos is trending before breakfast. The algorithm feeds us just the right recipe of suffering and rage bait across the entire planet to keep us distracted and angry. We're manipulated into doom scrolling through tragedy and outrage beyond any hope of resolution, and somehow miss the person sitting 3 feet away from us who's barely holding it together. The economy depends on us being saturated with information and starved for connection. We know everything about what's happening out there. And all many of us know about what's happening right here is that we can't take much more. And then along comes Jesus, reminding us of something remarkable. Every day, every moment, there is good seed being sown, seed capable of bearing unimaginably rich results, if only it were received in good soil.
"But hey now, stop with that kind of talk. That's bad for business. distracted person keeps on scrolling, keeps on being outraged over scandals and injustices that they have no hope of ever influencing.
And if you ever feel like it's harder than it's ever been to be just here and now, it's not because you're weak. It's because you're up against a system designed to keep you somewhere else. And that somewhere else-ness is deliberate, a strategy embraced by those who stand to benefit from our distraction, even while the seeds of promise are sown right in front of us. They're being pecked up by the birds of aggravation, getting lost among the rocks of discouragement and falling among the thorns of depression, eaten by the worms of corruption and injustice. And that is exactly why genuine spirituality, the deeper wisdom that so many of us are seeking, has never been about more information, more dogma, or more guarantees. It's about practice. It's about action, here and now, grounded in the reality of the present. When the world is this loud, this fast, this demanding, this aggravating, wisdom is drowned out. You have to till the soil, cultivate it, and prepare the ground so you're receptive to the seed that's being sown. Not someday, not somewhere else, but right in front of you. And across history, in every tradition, people have discovered ways, simple, embodied, repeatable ways to soften the soil, to train their attention, to clear a little space, so that when the seeds are scattered, and they are always being scattered, something in us is ready to receive them. You know some of the usual suspects associated with being spiritual in some way: meditation, labyrinth walking, Tai Chi, communing with nature, reading, journaling. But don't discount all the other ways our empathy, compassion, and awe are stirred: through music, an art museum, cooking, working out. Remember the movie Chariots of Fire? The main character, Eric Liddell, was an Olympic runner and was heard to say, "When I run, I can feel God's pleasure." Who knew that God's pleasure and endorphins were related? But there they are. So where, how, when do you quiet yourself, open yourself, focus yourself in such a way that you're open to the abundance of seeds being sown with wild abandon? And let's say we do swap out the I for a you and go from soil to soul. What practices do we cultivate to get us out of ourselves, to help melt away our self-centeredness and ego, to transcend the rampant individualism our culture promotes, and see beyond I and me to us, to you? I'm convinced that at the core of all the great religious practices, at the heart of every endeavor people have ever pursued to become more fully human, is the commitment to transcending self and recognizing that we are part of the whole, a whole that is critical to our survival as a species. You're going to be hard-pressed to convince me that the antidote to the epidemic of loneliness and isolation and the resolution to the hatred and suspicions between peoples and religions is anything other than embracing the reality that we are all inextricably interconnected. We are made of the same stuff. We're in this together. Most of you know that one of my favorite authors is Michael Pollan. from his earliest books on food and culture to his current book on consciousness. In his recent How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence, he tells the long and circuitous history of what have been called psychedelic drugs, including LSD and psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. I had no idea of the rich and profound impact this class of mysterious molecules have had on humanity throughout history, and that from time immemorial, shamans and mystics have tapped into their ego-melting, consciousness-expanding potential. And in the last few years, there's been a resurgence in research around the world into the therapeutic value of both LSD and psilocybin in the treatment of PTSD, anxiety, depression, and personality disorders. And one of the things that many test subjects report is a profound spiritual insight that's called a unitive experience, a deep, life-changing sense that we are all one with one another. And for those of you who have been conditioned into a knee-jerk reaction against anything even adjacent to psychedelics, let alone your pastor advocating their potential for spiritual enlightenment, be it known that researchers have heard you. They have taken to calling psychedelics entheogens, where N equals in or of, and theos equals the divine. In other words, a source of the divine. So whatever your discipline is, meditation, music, running, or someday, the legal availability of entheogens, we all need to be intentional about practices that help us break through the superficial distractions that preoccupy us, that help us loosen our grip on the idea that we are separate, self-contained individuals, and become more aware of the seeds being sown all around us. Friends, Jesus said the sower filled his hands with seeds. And from the sound of Jesus' story, the sower never stopped sowing with extravagance. But because we're not paying attention, most of us miss. In a world that is louder, faster, angrier, and more fragmented than anything any of us have ever known before, the question our parable asks of us today is, can we cultivate the kind of attention that allows something, anything, to take root? Because the problem isn't that nothing sacred is happening. The problem is how much of it we miss. Many years ago, when Morse code was the primary means of long-distance communication, a young man went to his local Western Union office to apply for a job as a telegraph operator. Upon entering, he was discouraged to find the lobby already full of applicants. Nevertheless, he sat down and started to fill out an application. But a moment later, he stopped, sprung up, and walked right through the door into the inner office. The other applicants were indignant, even more so when a man poked his head out of the door and announced that the job had been filled. The room erupted with shouts of, "We were here first, and how come he got in?" The man replied, "If you had been paying attention, you would have heard the Morse code tapping out the message, 'If you can understand this, come right in. You've got the job.'" The sower never stops sowing with wild abandon, even maybe especially in the places we least expect. in the midst of tragedy, outrage, despondency, it behooves us to pay attention to the presence of the Spirit, listening a little more intently for the murmurs of the transcendent. The real tragedy isn't that the seeds aren't being sown. The tragedy is how much of it we miss. Not because it's hidden, not because it's complicated, but because it's right in front of us. And we're somewhere else. If Thomas were writing today, maybe our passage would go something like this. Jesus said, "Don't be discouraged. Wisdom is always close at hand, like a steady, constant signal. But the world is a noisy place. Some receive it, but their attention is already crowded by headlines, by worries, and by the endless pull of whatever's next on the list. What was given is lost, not because it lacked power, but because it was never really heard. Some notice it for a moment. It resonates. It feels right. But with life pressing in all around, it fades because it never had a chance in the midst of the commotion. Some receive it, but their lives are so entangled with striving, comparison, and the quiet pressure to be more, do more, prove more, that it's just drowned out. Not in any dramatic way, just by the sheer volume of everything else. But some make space. They learn to be present. They resist the distraction of the noise long enough to notice what's important. And somewhere deep down, something takes hold. And what they nurture, what grows in them, not only sustains them, it begins to feed others. Not in ways that are always valued by the world rushing by, but in ways that are real, ways that make a difference in the long run. So, understand this. There is no shortage of that which gives life. There's only the question, can you recognize it when it's right in front of you? Be well.
Hey, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a copy.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.